Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive and to help me make it through grad school, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
Teach me to walk in the light of His love. Teach me to pray to my Father above. Teach me to know all the things that are right. Teach me to walk in the light.
But let's talk about that. I mean, it's pretty traumatic. You know, the classic things that start happening are the husband wants, you know, the non-believing spouse wants to take off their garments. The non-believing mm-hmm. spouse wants to stop going to church. The non-believing spouse, you know, doesn't know if they can perform an ordinance, you know, a baptism or a confirmation. Mm-hmm. The non-believing spouse wants to let the temple recommend expire. And it's very common that the non-believing spouse decides that there's no reason for them, since Joseph Smith drank wine and alcohol, since Jesus drank wine, that, you know, there's no reason not to occasionally have a beer or a glass of wine. So, you know, your perspective feels very mature to me, very almost non-typical, because usually the typical reaction to that by the believing spouse is anger and fear, and that the world is falling apart.
Yes.
And so how can you talk about how you guys navigated that?
Oh, sure. When I remember I had a phone conversation with you because we were basically negotiating as to whether or not my husband should be able to ordain our son when he had a priesthood, you know, advancement. And I was very concerned about being dishonest, that I was somehow, you know, being dishonest before God. And my husband felt like he should be able to do this ordination because he was he's the father of this child, and he wasn't, you know, unworthy in any way. And I had the phone conversation with you, and you said, look, there's a book in the Book of Mormon. It's a short book. I know you were driving in your car. I was driving in my car, and you couldn't come. You mentioned that the person said that he was a wicked man, and I knew exactly who you're talking about. And I said, that's Omni. And so I went home after a conversation. I read Omni, where he talks specifically about being a wicked man, that he had, you know, fought in many wars on behalf of the Nephites, but that he was a wicked man, but nevertheless, he was going to record this portion of the record because that was his duty. And I remember sending you an email saying, look, I've prayed about this, I've studied this, and Omni was not a spiritual follower of Christ, but he did his temporal duty in bringing forth the Book of Mormon. And as I started to apply that to my husband, I realized, okay, my husband is not a spiritual Mormon. He may never have been a spiritual Mormon. Maybe he was a logical Mormon, but now he's not a logical Mormon. What is he? Well, I guess he's a temporal Mormon. He's a temporal Mormon. He is going to be involved in things that are physical. And for me, I am like a rock solid believer in the priesthood. I think it's real. I don't think it's an idea. I think it's a physical power, so to speak, that is transferred from one person to another. And I believe that when my husband was given that priesthood, it was given to him in the sense of that he has this power. And whether or not he believes in the legitimacy of the priesthood doesn't matter. I think the priesthood is bigger than any one man. It's bigger than Joseph Smith. It's bigger than Brigham Young. It's bigger than my husband's unbelief. And if he has done nothing to render himself unworthy to act as a priesthood holder, then who am I to say that he is somehow not worthy to perform those ordinances? It helped me a lot to go through that process and logically look at things, because here are these men, they're priesthood holders, and we have all of these different recordings through church history and all of these different things that show that they were not perfect. At times they sinned. At times they transgressed, made mistakes. But nevertheless, the church was able to keep functioning. Priesthood ordinances were performed. And by golly, if those people could somehow maintain their priesthood authority, then I felt like my husband could too. And so I really let go of this concept that my husband had to believe everything in order to be a worthy priesthood holder. And that helped me tremendously, because I was able to again see my husband as, for lack of a better word, the patriarch in our home. We don't really have a patriarchal type house. You know, my husband and I are, you know, equals in our home, but I no longer had this feeling of fear that there was no priesthood in my home. I felt like he was worthy in every way to lead our children and help me parent them. I didn't fear him sort of participating in those kind of ordinances. It became a relief to me, and I look forward to the day when that will happen.
So did he perform any ordinances as a semi-believer or non-believer, or not yet?
He has not performed an ordinance at church as far as our son being ordained, but he has given a father's blessing to our daughter. And it was interesting to see him sort of work his way through that, but it made her feel better, and it calmed her fears and anxieties, and it made them closer. How can that be considered bad in any way?
Right. One big question I have, there's a lot of believing spouses out there, mm-hmm. who, you know, the extreme reaction is, that's it, their marriage is over, I'm gone. Okay. And that happens.
Yes. Sadly.
There's another reaction, which is get it together, become a believer again, because, you know, if we can't work this through, I'm gone. It's less immediate, but, you know, the results often end up being the same. Now, you're also atypical a bit in that, you were writing me from the very beginning saying, I don't care, I want to preserve the marriage. There are a lot of spouses out there where that's not the reaction. The reaction is, bargain is over, the contract has been broken, I'm out of here. And, you know, you could write some of those off to people who just had a crappy marriage and they're just looking for any way out. But I think...
Sure.
You could also say that there are many who just, you know, celestial kingdom, exaltation, eternal marriage, that's just like, you know, they're married to God and the church and, you know, exaltation, and the spouse is just the person that they chose to achieve that ends with. And so, you know, let's say that there are some people in that boat who are listening right now. What could we or you tell them to make an appeal that a marriage is worth saving, even if it's not what they signed up for?
Well, I guess the first thing that I would say is,
like, how do we know that God doesn't want the believing spouse to leave the disbelieving spouse?
Well, first of all, when if somebody is willing to leave a marriage simply because their spouse no longer believes, then I feel that person does not have a, I don't want to judge anybody, but I don't think that they have gained the ultimate testimony of the sealing power. I believe in the sealing power. I believe that my husband and I are sealed. He does not. He does not believe that we are sealed. But I believe that the sealing power is stronger than his unbelief. And that perhaps my husband's faith crisis is the trial that I have to go through in this life in order to prove to my Heavenly Father that I am worthy to be sealed to this man. I am willing to put everything on the line because I love this man. And I have made a choice to put my love for him and our marriage at the front of the line when it comes to everything in my life. Which means that I have to be willing to live a life of faith as opposed to what I used to consider, I guess, a life of knowledge. Now I'm living by faith. I have faith that God is going to honor our sealing. I have faith that if for some reason, you know, I live a life good enough to inherit the celestial kingdom, that my husband will be there with me. But here's the deal. If he's not there, I don't want to be there. I want to be wherever he is because I'm sealed to him, not the celestial kingdom. I want my husband, not just some faceless eternal companion. I want him. I also think it's important that people remember that there are a lot of ways that the deal can change. People get sick. People get in car accidents and become paralyzed from the neck down. And the spouse that is not harmed is there to take care of the person. There are so many ways that the agreement can change. That this is just one more facet of for better or for worse. This is just one more way of showing, you know, God that I love this person. I'm sealed to this person. I am willing to serve my spouse for the rest of my life.
Hmm. Kind of gives eternal marriage a whole new meaning.
Exactly. And, you know, it really made me think about eternal marriage and why marriages fail. I mean, you know, the divorce rate within our church is not significantly lower than the general population. And Eric and I happen to have seen a lot of divorces of people that were married in the temple. And we couldn't figure out how these people that had been married in the temple and had such great families, how they could end up getting divorced. And I started to feel like maybe because Mormons see eternity as being locked in, like somehow our eternal lives are locked in. We went to the temple, we're sealed, everything's fine. We forget to tend to the day-to-day needs of our marriages and our spouses. And then before we know it, it's gone. The love is gone, the marriage fails, whatever it is. But I really do think that this experience has given me, has strengthened my testimony of eternal marriage and given me a real lesson in what it means. So it does. It really brings new meaning to the term.
Have you guys had the conversations with your family, your parents since then, or are they still unaware?
They are unaware.
To this day, your parents don't know that your husband has struggled.
Correct.
Wow.
And I don't know if they'll ever know. my husband is reticent to hurt them. He loves my parents and does not want to cause them stress, you know, or pain in their older years. I have faith that my parents would still love him, but I really believe that it's my husband's information to share. And when he's ready, we don't have a secretive household. Our children know that we definitely do not have an Orthodox Mormon family.
If you don't mind, this is the biggest question I get. How do you communicate this to the kids? How do you finesse it? And how do you accommodate it and adapt? So go into as much detail or tips or tricks as you're able to on approaching the children about these changes. And if your approach has been to just minimize any disruption, that's cool too, but go into as much detail as you can.
Okay. Well, at first, we did not really discuss this with the kids in the sense of we just kept things going for them the same as always. But my husband does not attend church.
So he stopped going completely.
He goes to sacrament meeting once in a while, but it's difficult for him. And so he has found another faith that has meaning for him. And so he will often, when he comes to sacrament meeting, he leaves either a bit early from sacrament meeting or right after to go attend this other denomination. And I have gone with him a few times because he is wonderful and comes to church with me. And I feel like I want to be part of his religious life because I want to understand every aspect of him. I want to know every aspect of him. And so I want to go to that church with him when I can. But the kids know that he does not go to church often and that he leaves right after sacrament meeting. And we've talked about that. We have a coffee maker on our counter, and that part of our home was sort of introduced slowly in the sense that we talked about just when different conversations had come up about things they had learned at church, about the Word of Wisdom. We discussed the fact that the Word of Wisdom is sort of it's about obedience. It's about, you know, trying to be the best person you can be, but that some of the aspects of the Word of Wisdom don't make sense. Hot drinks means coffee and tea, and yet we drink hot chocolate. Is it the caffeine in the coffee and tea that's bad for you, but yet it's okay to drink Coke? You know,
So you went into this with your kids?
Absolutely.
Now, what are the ages of your kids?
Our youngest is 13, and we have a 15-year-old and an almost 21-year-old.
Now,
aren't
you worried that you're teaching your kids to be relativistic and to not take the commandments seriously? I mean, as a parent, I want my kids to obey all the commandments that are, you know, that are constructive. So,
sure.
For example, the Word of Wisdom for me is, like, you know, really important, although, you know, I don't have a problem with people who want to drink wine or beer or whatever. But for me, that's something I wouldn't want my kids slacking off on just because of the way I was raised. So isn't that kind of scary? And then you think, oh, what about the slippery slope? And what if they start making the law of chastity something that is just, well, they can talk their way out of it? Like, have you thought about those implications, or is it just you're going to do what is right and let the consequences follow?
But my number one goal is to never let my children believe that their father is anything but a wonderful man. And so by slowly introducing to them the concept that there really is nothing evil about coffee. That, you know, I don't drink it because I want to have a temple recommend, and that is the current guideline for, you know, having a temple recommend. Although I feel like if somebody did drink coffee and felt like they were worthy, that that's not my place to judge them, but it's just, it's not, coffee's not my cup of tea. I just don't drink it. And I don't drink tea either, but I drink hot chocolate and I drink peppermint tea, which is made with the same hot water as regular tea. And also the word of wisdom, people answer that they keep the word of wisdom in a temple recommend interview when I know that they eat meat in times other than famine.
Right.
And so what part of the word of wisdom is it somehow okay to not keep? And then these other parts are terrible to break. I really feel like it's my responsibility as the believing parent to teach my children tolerance and compassion and empathy, because I do not want them hit in the face with their father's disaffection the way I was. I love my children enough to let them lose some of this idealism in favor of pragmatism as they mature and grow, so that their relationship with their father is never compromised.
What would you say, though, to someone who said, you're sacrificing the commandments so that your kids can have a better perspective or view on their dad? Like, you're cheapening the commandments someone might accuse you of. Do you feel like you're doing that and you're just saying, yep, that's what I'm doing? Or do you see it differently?
No, I see it differently. I, first of all, one of the first, you know, one of the most important commandments is to honor thy father and thy mother. And any religion that teaches children to dishonor a parent because of a beverage that they drink is out of line. Any religion that comes into my home and tells me that I cannot do this or I must do this in order to separate my children from their father is out of line. My Heavenly Father would never want me to do anything to lessen my children's father in their eyes.
That's really good. So you're honoring, you're obeying a commandment by encouraging your kids to honor their father.
Yeah.
And I guess you can, in that case, I mean, there is no question that Jesus drank wine, that Joseph Smith drank wine and beer, that prophets all the way up into the early 20th century, prophets and apostles drank beer and alcohol. That is irrefutable. So, I mean, you've got that on your side as well.
Yeah, and I want my children to not be compelled in all things. I want them to see that these things are choices from all these other choices that are available in life. And if, you know, if this is something that if somebody drinks coffee, it does not mean they're a bad person.
I think the pioneers brought coffee over, right?
Yeah, it was part of their supply list that they had to have. Yeah. And you know, I really don't think that the word of wisdom is about coffee or beer. I see the word of wisdom as loving advice from a father in heaven to find a way to control our appetites. Because anything that controls us makes our life less enjoyable. And so if a person can have a beer and just watch a football game and drink a beer, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. If a person can have a nice cup of coffee in the morning to brighten their day and you know, get out the door, whatever it is, there's nothing wrong with that. If somebody drinks 25 cups of coffee a day and is, you know, shaking all the time, there's a problem. And somebody who drinks to excess and becomes intoxicated and drives or all the different things that can happen, that's not good. But the fact is, and this is something that so many Latter-day Saints do not understand, the vast majority of people on this earth drink alcohol. Rarely to the point of becoming drunk, mostly as just a one drink, probably, you know, a couple times a week. Most people do not become alcoholics. Most people who drink coffee have one or two cups and get on with their day. These are things that provide us with some guidelines for healthy living, because Heavenly Father wants our spirits to be the master of our body, not the other way around. But taking anything to that kind of an extreme is unhealthy. I do not say that I have got the only way for people to run their homes. All I'm saying is that I made a decision, I made a conscious decision, that my marriage and my family was not going to be broken up because of this.
Right.
So I take every day as it comes, and I try to be understanding. But when I try to control my husband, he resents it. And you know what? Satan wanted to control us. Right. And we would have resented it. That's not the way it works. We have to find a way to be open to our spouses that are going through these changes. And that doesn't mean that you throw your belief to the wind. It isn't like that.
Well, what about the spouse that says there's got to be boundaries? Because first it's coffee, then it's alcohol, then it's adultery, you know, pornography, whatever, you know, whatever people's fears might invoke. You know, there has to be some lines, right?
Well, I guess it depends on where you feel that the lines are important. I think that we have to understand that the only person that we can control in this life is ourselves. If my husband is going to drink a beer, he's going to do it, whether I know about it or not. Do I really want my husband sneaking around to a bar to have a beer? Or would I rather have my husband at home with me, relaxing on our bed, watching TV, having a beer, where I can, you know, lay my head on his shoulder and we can talk? Do I want that to happen? Or do I want him away from our home with strangers? How does that strengthen my marriage?
Right. What about adultery and, you know, the worst case scenario, that kind of stuff?
Well, I believe that my number one job as a wife is to give my husband every reason to come home from work every day to me. That doesn't mean that I stop being who I am, but I give him the freedom to be who he is. And I really believe that if someone's going to commit adultery, beer has nothing to do with it. I think that becoming intoxicated definitely will lower someone's inhibitions. But I think that you have to know your spouse. I know my spouse, and I know that my husband is faithful to me. But if he was going to be unfaithful to me, he has plenty of opportunities to do it. He has to travel sometimes for business. He's away from me at his job, you know, 10 hours during the day. And I have no way of knowing what he's doing every minute. And I would make myself crazy if I had to know those things, where he was at every minute. So I do everything I can to make my husband feel comfortable in our home. And I think it's important that that word, our, is emphasized. This is our home.
And I guess plenty of spouses who are believing members cheat on their spouses too. So it's not like, you know, there has to be a correlation there. I mean, Adultery happens within the church all the time, with the between believing members.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what would you say to someone who says, I'm listening to Jackie. It sounds like Jackie's making all of the accommodations. It sounds like she's a doormat wife. She's going to support her husband if he wants to have a beer, support her husband if he wants to, you know, go on active. And she's going to love him no matter what. And he's sort of getting the man's dream. No responsibility, you know, no mutual sacrifice. Gets to watch the football games, and Jackie's the doormat. Well, let's say someone was sort of having that suspicion. Can you talk about, from his perspective, whether you feel like he's met you halfway?
Well, I've never felt that marriage was 50-50. I had an institute teacher tell me once that good marriages are 90-90. It takes both people giving everything they have all the time. Now, some days, one of us isn't going to have the 90 to give. And that's just the way it is. But I guess from a true, you know, totally believing LDS person, they might feel like I'm being a doormat and I'm making all the accommodations. I don't see that as the case. I do feel like my husband is receiving unconditional love from me. I love him. The things that are going on in his life have nothing to do with the way that I feel about him. I am not going to accept everything that comes down the pike. He knows that, but I'm trying to be as accommodating as I can because I love him. I'm trying to show my children what a healthy marriage is like. I'm trying to help them understand that not everything in life stays the same. I feel like the only training in disaffection that my children may get is going to be played out right here in our home. How would I want my son to be treated by his future spouse if he was to become disaffected? Would I want him thrown out on the street? Would I want her to take the grandchildren and leave? No. And likewise, I would not want my daughters to do that to their husbands if it was to happen, or vice versa.
Right.
There are women who become disaffected too.
Right.
And anybody who knows me knows that I'm not a doormat.
Yeah, I can vouch for that. Well, I guess what I was trying to get at is, I've spoken with enough disaffected members of the church to know that it actually is a huge sacrifice for them to be supportive of their believing spouse, to be non-disruptive to the kids' spiritual journeys. To even go to church, to even step foot in the chapel. I mean, for the believer, this is going to sound just ludicrous that is a sacrifice. But can you talk about that?
Oh, my husband, just going to sacrament meeting with us takes everything he's got. When he leaves sacrament meeting, he's wiped out. He truly is giving everything he's got. My husband, if it were just him, he would resign from the church. He would really like to be out. I've asked him to please not resign. That is a request that I have made of him that I feel is probably putting him in a box a little bit. It's something that I'm trying to work on within myself, but it's sort of a line that is difficult for me. I want him to not give up his membership. And it's something that we're working through, but he struggles. He sees our children being trained in the gospel that he no longer believes in and that he feels is damaging. There are things about the church that he thinks are positive, but he also feels that there are things that are damaging, and yet he supports me, supports our children. He does not express his anger or resentment, call it what you will, towards the church. He never expresses that to our children.
That is not only remarkable in terms of how rare, because usually the disbelieving spouse is just always looking for the chance to take jabs, not because they're bad people, but just because they feel so, they want the truth to be out there. They feel so angry. It's just almost impossible to not make smirks, to laugh behind your breath, to take the kids aside. And so the extent to which he's not doing that, I think, actually is a huge amount of, showing a huge amount of restraint and respect.
Oh, sure. And, you know, I don't see myself as this martyr that's giving everything up for my marriage. I see my husband as giving just as much. I see us both trying to make our marriage work. I can totally understand if my husband was angry with me for staying. I could understand him feeling that way. If that, you know, I mean, he doesn't feel that way, but I could understand it. My husband does not understand how I can believe in anything that I believe in. It's a mystery to him. He loves me. He thinks that I'm bright and a wonderful wife, but I am constantly a mystery to him because he does not understand how I can believe. And yet he loves me anyway. He's here. He comes home every night and, you know, has dinner with us. And, you know, sometimes it's him cooking dinner and sometimes it's me. But I think that one of the most important things that we have to realize is that doubting is not a sin. Doubting is not a sin. My husband, by doubting the church and its, you know, validity, commits no sin. And likewise, believing is not folly. I am not a feather brain, misled dupe because I believe.
Right.
But I think that the part about doubting is not sin is the hardest thing for believing members of our church to get their head around. Because that's why we treat disaffected people the way we do. Because we believe that doubt equals sin, that the act of doubting is a sin. And that is unfortunate because I just don't believe it.
Right.
And, you know, I really don't think we should be teaching that.
Right. So what's it like being effectively for the people at church, you know, a single mom, a single believer, going to church alone? You know, how is that?
Well, it was weird at first. You know, my husband would go to sacrament meeting with me, but then leave. And so going to gospel doctrine class is always interesting because there's all these couples sitting together and the people who are alone in there, they often put their scriptures on their chair, on the chair next to them to make sure that nobody sits by them. And so you sort of gain the talent of just sitting alone in gospel doctrine class. Although I started to just seek out the women that were truly single, divorced women or women that had never been married. They became my friends, and I really started to gain empathy for them because I started to see so much of the doctrine that is preached at church through the eyes of someone who does not have the cookie cutter, the promised eternal marriage. My eternal marriage, everything about it is based on faith. And so when I go to Relief Society or Gospel Doctrine and I hear some of the doctrine that is preached about being a servant, an angel to those who are exalted and some things like that, it's kind of sad. And I'm just gaining such an insight as far as what so many women and men in the church go through because they're not married or because they're not married to a member. And I tell you something, there have been times in class when I have just put my arm around the single gal next to me and just said, I don't believe that. And neither should you. Your life isn't over because you're not married yet, or your life isn't over because you're divorced. You know, we can do this. We can find ways of making our place in this church. And I used to always, when I was in the Relief Society presidency, I would tell sisters who were single or who had been sealed in the temple and then gotten divorced and now they're remarried and they've got children from that first marriage and children from the second marriage and they didn't know who are my children going to be sealed to? And I would always say to them, you know, that's not something you need to worry about because Heavenly Father is going to work all of that out for you. You don't have to worry about a thing. Well, now I have to take my own advice and sort of put myself into that category. I'm sort of going by faith, and Heavenly Father's going to have to work all that out for me. It's going to be a busy guy.
Right. How have the church leaders acted, and home teachers and members? Like, do you think members have a sense that, you know, ward members have a sense for what's going on? Do you think they just think he works on Sundays? Like, you know, how the ward members acted or not acted?
Well, I think that some of the ward members probably have an idea that something's going on. I think that, you know, for my husband, he's done a lot of, you know, bobbing and weaving, not returning phone calls, that sort of a thing. Recently had a discussion with our bishop where he basically informed the bishop that I can't hold a calling. I can't be a home teacher. I'm really only involved in this for my family. And I thought it was good. I thought it was a good conversation because the expectations that will be put upon my husband are obviously less, which I think will reduce his stress load. And that's a good thing.
How did you do that without having the bishop assume that it was for adultery or pornography or some heinous, you know, sin yeah. in the bishop's eyes?
Well, we went to the bishop's office together. I felt like it was important for us to show not a united front, like it's some sort of confrontation, but I wanted the bishop to understand that nothing was going to come between my husband and myself. And we had the discussion, and he wanted to know why my husband had this position. And we had decided before we went that we were not going to get into any discussions about the issues that led to my husband's disaffection. That was not the time or the place for it, and that it really isn't anyone's business unless, you know, we get farther down the road and something has to be said. But we just basically said, we're not going to talk about it right now, but this is where I'm at. And when the bishop was sort of probing a little bit more, I said, look, I think that my husband's thoughts and feelings and beliefs are in a state of flux right now. Which they are. And these guidelines that we're sort of laying down are not just for him, but to help make things go better at church. And our bishop was so great, he said, look, the church is here to serve the people, not the people serving the church. And although, you know, what is the church but the people, I liked the attitude that he had that, look, whatever you can give, we're happy to accept. He didn't kick us out of the ward. He was great. He just wanted to know how he could serve our family. I felt like it was the best possible outcome, but it definitely is good that my husband does not have to have the stress hanging over his head of receiving a teaching calling or being a home teacher, things that he does not feel that he can honestly take on right now.
Right. So the bishop was pretty cool about it.
He was.
And you took an approach of no details, avoid being threatening in any way.
Yeah, we weren't trying to be threatening. We had discussed some guidelines with him as to how we want our children dealt with at church, because we just had some specific requests, and we made those requests, and they were sort of new requests to him, but he, you know, we're the parents, and he was certainly willing to work with us on those. And then after that, my husband sort of laid out his position, and I also informed the bishop that because of some of these things, we would not be at church every Sunday. That there would be Sundays when our family would need to be together, strengthening our family unit away from the church. And he understood.
Wow, sounds like you have a cool bishop.
I thought he was great.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Also, this is a shout out to my tragically hip friends at StudioCase.com in New York City. That includes Travis, Jeff, Enoch, and Tony for designing my new Mormon Stories podcast logo. Please check these amazingly talented guys out at StudioCase.com or email to thank them at info@StudioCase.com. And finally, music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at ClaytonPixton.com or SkyPixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, Pixton.com. Thank you. For loving guidance to show us the way, grateful we praise thee with songs of delight. Gladly, we'll walk in.